need to know that there are going to be people who have your back. So every educator should know the majority of your community probably has your back. And so silence should not be your option when you see these attacks resulting in things that will hurt kids.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, to another episode of All the Above, the show that gives you an unstandardized take on education. I'm Jeffrey Garrett, one of your co-hosts, and I've been a middle and high school principal and a high school social studies teacher. And as always, I'm joined by...
What up, family? It's Manuel Rustin, your favorite teacher's favorite teacher. I'm a high school history teacher here in the Los Angeles area, and I am currently wrapping up year 20 in the classroom. Shout out to everybody joining us for the first time. We here at All of the Above very much love and appreciate you. Of course, this is where you can find the latest news and information on all things pertaining to our world of education. If you are checking us out on YouTube, please consider hitting that thumbs up and also find us on your favorite podcast streaming app, because we don't always drop video platform type episodes. We have little joints in between called passing periods where it's just Jeff and myself talking about the latest stories in education. Jeff, man, we are deep into May now. It is full-blown commencement season. Jeff, I want to know, what's your favorite part of commencement season?
Oh, wow. Okay. That is a tough question to answer, Manuel, because there's so many good things about commencement season. It is like, for those who maybe don't work in education or don't work in high schools in particular, because I know nowadays there's like kindergarten graduation and, you know, middle school culmination and all that stuff, but like, it just hits different in high school. I'm sorry to say, but, it is like, there's just a few times for most of us in our life where everyone comes together to celebrate like the fact that we're here and we made it to this point in life, right? And like, it's like your birth, your graduation from, you know, from high school, your marriage, and your death, right? Like, there's only a few times. Now, of course, I'm being a little dramatic there, but it is like, it's on that list of like, ritualized celebrations of you, and that you have like made it to this point that we acknowledge. So I don't know, Manuel, this is like a non-answer answer, but I think I would say my answer is just the like the gathering of all the families, all the grandmas and the aunts and the uncles and the parents and the siblings, you know, the little ones in the strollers, and like everyone coming together to be like, yep, you did it. We see you. You're an adult now. You know, like this ritualized transition point in life, which is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I think my favorite part, being a high school teacher and having attended a lot of high school graduations, just when certain names get called and the family gets just so loud, like there's certain particular students, like, the, you know, the name will get called and just the raucous like reaction is so loud, and it's like, I didn't even realize this student rolled so deep to graduation. There's like 50 people up there shouting. That's my favorite, because it's just, it's kind of hilarious, but it's also so touching and so warm. But my least favorite part is a recent development, at least at my high school. I don't know, each year more and more, I guess, dignitaries show up to like be up there on stage. So like last year, for each student, when they, you know, name gets called and they cross the stage, there were like so many people up there, like board members and other folks like shaking the hands. It was like a line of like 20 people up there. I'm like, this is ridiculous. That's too many folks up there shaking hands. This is taking too long.
Yeah.
The kids don't know most of these folks. There's got to be some kind of, I don't know, it's probably unique just to my school, but we got to come up with some kind of protocol, man, because it was like too many folks up there, and it was just like ridiculous.
Yeah, I think like 2 to 3 is the cap on what
that
it
makes
be,
sense.
You know, yeah, like principal, maybe a board member, and then like the, you know, the person reading the names, if you know, if it's like a teacher or counselor or something, right? Like that's about it. Everybody else can still be on stage and like wave and stuff like that. The kids can run and give them a hug if they, you know, if it's someone they know. I feel you on that. That's a little much.
Yeah, it was unhinged, man. It was unhinged. There was too many hands up there. Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff, we are here again with another full episode. Of course, folks who've been rocking with us rocking with us for a minute know that our full episodes feature super dope guests, as well as other things. So, Jeff, what's on the agenda for today?
Well, Manuel, today we got a good one for everybody, as per usual. And I'm here to say that the streak remains intact. 114 episodes of dopeness.
Yeah.
Continuing today, Manuel, with really an incredible guest, someone I'm super excited to have on. Manuel and I actually met this individual when she was an instructor in our first experience, our first dipping the toe into graduate school in our educator training program, where she was a doctoral student. Her name is Dr. Heather Harding. Some folks may know of her because she spent a number of years working for Teach for America. She now runs a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C. that helps advocate for the protection of America's public schools. So we're going to dig into a conversation about how to protect and serve our nation's public schools in this crazy environment where DEI is the boogeyman and, you know, folks are really out here coming for educators, for school boards, etc. Dr. Harding is organizing the resistance. So we're going to talk to her. We're going to dig into this fascinating discussion today. Stick around, folks. You definitely don't want to miss it.
Oh, I love that. Sounds dope. Sounds dope. But of course, first we have our Do Now, where we take a look at recent news and headlines in the world of education. That's coming up next, folks. Stay tuned. All right, folks, now it's time for today's Do Now. Jeff, how are we going to do the Do Now today?
Well, Manuel, today we got a little pop quiz for everybody. Manuel, I know you didn't see this coming, folks. If you didn't do your homework, you might be in trouble. But thinking caps on, it's time for a pop quiz.
Mr. Garrett, it's the end of the school year. Can't we just relax? It's almost summer. Can't we just chill? We got all these other projects for all these other classes, all these finals, Mr. Garrett. Why do we have to do a pop quiz?
Well, see, what's going to happen is we're going to do this here pop quiz. Then we're going to pop in a video, okay? And so I'll meet you in the middle.
Pop in a video. That's pretty old school there, Mr. Garrett. Pretty old school.
I know. I know. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
All right, then.
I'm going to wheel the TV cart down to the classroom and then put away my overhead projector, and we're going to pop in a videotape. Okay.
There we go.
Yes.
All right. All right. Let's knock out this pop quiz then so we can get to that videotape. So, Jeff, the first question for this week's pop quiz is, where can we find the most reasoned voices in education?
The most reasoned voices in education. Well, obviously, Manuel, I think that would be at the top. You know, clearly it would be the White House, Congress, state houses, governor's mansions. I mean, clearly these people only got to those places because they are the most reasoned voices in education. That's my answer. I'm sticking to it.
All right. Ding, ding, ding. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. You are correct, Jeff. Congress, specifically the U.S. Congress, you know, features a lot of really sound, reasoned individuals who are thoughtful and informed, of course. And this story has to do with a very thoughtful and informed hearing that recently took place in Congress around anti-Semitism in K-12 schools, and more specifically, a California representative who went back and forth with a California superintendent on the issue of ethnic studies. All right, so let's jump into it. We pulled the story from a few different sources, but main source being EdSource, thanks to some reporting by John Fensterwald. And John reports that earlier this month, Berkeley Unified School District Superintendent Enikia Ford Morthel, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, she was among a trio of superintendents who were questioned at the House Education and Workforce Committee hearing on anti-Semitism in K-12 schools. U.S. Representative Kevin Kiley, a first-term Republican congressman representing California's 3rd District, which spans most of the California-Nevada border, sparred with the superintendent and denounced her district's choice of consultant to create an ethnic studies curriculum. Kylie pressed Superintendent Ford Morthal about the Liberated Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum Consortium, whose leaders include ethnic studies professors from the California State University System, as well as the University of California. The group offers training, materials, and consultation to help districts implement ethnic studies, and they were hired by Berkeley Unified on a one-year contract in June of 2023 to serve as what Ford Morthal called a thought partner. The Liberated Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum Consortium was founded by the original authors of California's Model Curriculum for Ethnic Studies, which was criticized by pro-Israel voices for its critique of Israel. The Jewish Legislative Caucus criticized the original curriculum's view of Israel and Palestine, as well as its favorable definition of the Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement, which calls for sanctions and boycotts of Israel. Governor Gavin Newsom called that original document, quote, insufficiently balanced and inclusive. Finding themselves excluded from the revisions process and much of their material on Arab American studies wholly removed from that curriculum, the authors disavowed the final version of the curriculum and founded the Liberated Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum Consortium. The consortium's contract with Berkeley Unified is up for renewal next month. Some Jewish parents in Berkeley have written the school board opposing the contract. In their letter, the parents criticized the consortium as pushing a, quote, non-inclusive, biased, divisive, and one-sided ideological worldview, end quote. So, Jeff, here we have it again, a story that has come up many times over the last couple of years here in California. This idea, or this, I guess, controversy over ethnic studies and how it treats Israel and Palestine. And in this particular case, the Liberated Ethnic Studies Model Consortium and accusations of it being too one-sided and too biased against Israel. What are your thoughts here, Jeff? Sound, reasoned critique from a U.S. congressman?
You know, Manuel, I'm so disappointed, I think is perhaps the right word, but it's not the right word because it's predictable, the level of shenanigans right. and ridiculousness that we're seeing here. So it's hard to be disappointed in an institution in which you have no expectations for anything good to come out of it. So I don't know what the right word is. Maybe some English teachers out there can help me with the right synonym here. But if I were to put it in an expression, I think my response would be something like, okay, this is where we are. Okay, imagine this imagery, folks. Now, I don't know anything really at all about this particular representative who was questioning the good superintendent from Berkeley, but I know the image that I saw of this questioning, which appeared to be a white man questioning a black woman, accusing her of, you know, organizing some campaign of state-sponsored anti-Semitism. White man who belongs, I guess, not sure of his particular ethnic background, but just going off of what I saw on video. White man who belongs to the party of white nationalism and white supremacy, the party of Jews will not replace us, okay? The party of Nazis outside of Disneyland, okay? The party of straight up Nazis who are members of Congress, the Steve Kings and whatnot of the world, okay? Like the actual for real anti-Semites, okay? The people who look at World War II and empathize with the Germans, okay? Empathize with, I should say, the Nazis, not just the Germans, right? Like these are the people who are accusing this woman and this collection, by extension, of, you know, educators, scholars, activists who organize around this Liberated Ethnic Studies curriculum, of being the, you know, the projectors of anti-Semitism into the world. It would be insane, right? It would be laughable if it weren't so extremely dangerous, right? And just deeply insulting, right? To have this, you know, sort of juxtaposition thrown on camera, and of course these kind of trap questions asked of her and other politicians, most of whom also quoted in the article, folks, I suggest you click on the link below and go read it for yourself, because there's a whole lot of high-profile politicians here in California and elsewhere who answered wrongly on the questions that they were asked, you know, relating to this issue, including our governor who wants to be president someday. So, Manuel, I am, you know, whatever version of the word disappointed is the right version by this. But also, I think this is, you know, we for a reason, have a swag for our show that has the phrase, teach the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. By the way, folks, go to aotashow.com/support to get your Teach the Truth shirts, mugs, and other swag for yourself. Side note. But we have that slogan for a reason, Manuel, because we are living in these dystopian times where the simple act of speaking truth into the world is seen as, you know, a dangerous thing, is a revolutionary thing, is something that will be weaponized against you. And to have people in, you know, in the halls of Congress at this point in world history, where there is an objective truth right now, it doesn't matter whether you think it's the right thing to do, which I would say you probably really need to look in the mirror and do some, you know, some deep reflecting, maybe talk to your spiritual advisor or your therapist about this. But it doesn't matter if you think that the ethnic cleansing and the genocide that's taking place in Palestine right now is the right thing to do in response to Hamas or whatever other boogeyman you would like to, you know, you would like to assign it to. There are facts. There are truthful things happening in the world right now. And we are talking about tens of thousands of people murdered in the last 6 months who are objectively civilians, healthcare workers, journalists. We're talking about the bombing of residential buildings, the destruction of hospitals, systematic torture, dispossession of land, burning of, you know, of agricultural crops, destroying of water purification facilities, turning off telecommunications and internet service and electricity, depriving people of fuel for heat and cooking during the winter. We're talking about things that are, objectively speaking, very clearly crimes against humanity. There's no doubt about it. There's simply no doubt about it. We don't need to actually discuss that part. And so the, you know, the sort of pretend charade that's happening in the halls of Congress, that's, you know, the pressure, the downward pressure that's being put on, you know, education leaders, like we see in this, you know, in this case of Berkeley, is extremely dangerous, Manuel. This is the kind of thing that enables the getting away with the crimes of genocide by pressuring educators to not talk about it. By pressuring, I mean, I don't even know if we have to pressure our mainstream media. They don't want to talk about it, largely. And so, you know, they want to talk about protesting students as though they are the, you know, the problem here. And so, yeah. You know, I'm disgusted, maybe is the right word, Manuel. And I really hope we start seeing some real courage from people in positions of power, courage in the form of willingness to lose one's job, if it really comes down to that, to stand in the face of these folks who want us to not speak truth about what is happening in Israel and Palestine or happening in America. The fact of Israel being a settler colonialist state is no more in question than the fact of the United States or Canada being a settler colonialist state, right? Like, these are just basic truths. We, you know, you could think whatever you want to think about it, but, you know, the truth is. And so I hope, Manuel, out of this, we get some collective courage to say the truth in the face of weaponized power like this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in this hearing, they tried to catch these superintendents in a trap, just like what last fall they caught a lot of university presidents in that trap of anti-Semitism, what counts and what doesn't count. And in this one, you know, folks, if you read the story or watch the video, you'll see that the questioning definitely tried to trap these superintendents into really just like strict limited yes or no questions or answers related to such phrases as from the river to the sea and what have you. So, you know, kudos for this superintendent and others for seeing through that, because here we have a question about ethnic studies and how ethnic studies should deal with, or whether ethnic studies should deal at all with Israel and Palestine. And, you know, the original draft of California's model curriculum, just a reminder, folks, it was authored by university scholars and practitioners of ethnic studies, like actual experts in ethnic studies. And those are the folks who are the leaders of the Liberated Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum Consortium, like actual university experts. And it's funny because ethnic studies is one of those subjects and topics where folks who are not experts in it think that they have a standing to tell the experts what is supposed to be ethnic studies and what's not. Like, we don't do that for other folks. When I, you know, I happen to enjoy watching the common TikTok video on astrophysics and watching, you know, YouTube videos about this and that. But when I see an astrophysicist, I don't try to debate him on what astrophysics actually is or what counts or what doesn't count. I know that I'm no expert, and I know that I have no grounds to stand on when it comes to trying to like codify and define what exactly counts as astrophysics and what doesn't. But when it comes to ethnic studies, here we have a congressional representative seeming to think that he has a right to criticize the district's hiring of these ethnic studies professionals for their consultation. And, you know, obviously, yeah, all the words that you said, of course, sad, disappointed, all that. But it's also just very, very frustrating. It's very frustrating. And especially now, because when this first when this controversy first started in relative to ethnic studies and Israel and Palestine and the model curriculum, that was like 2019. Now, here we are in 2024, and it's more clear than ever that students really need guidance in understanding the history and the context of what's happening with Palestine and the ongoing genocide. It's clear that young people have questions, and ethnic studies, that original curriculum was set up to try to help students find answers, or at least the tools to get closer to an answer to help understand all that's happening. In that original draft, honestly, like the heavy critiques were about what I would consider to be pretty small things. There was a glossary included that had a whole lot of different key terms. One of those key terms was the BDS movement. So folks were pro-Israel folks were up in arms about that even being included, and that being included as anything other than what they considered to be a super negative, inappropriate thing for schools. It was just, you know, there's just really, really weak criticisms. Looking back on it, I think it's more clear than ever that they were very weak criticisms. So now we have all these allegations that are completely unfounded about ethnic studies being anti-Semitic, or at least the Liberate Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum Consortium being anti-Semitic or bringing anti-Semitism into schools. It's just not that at all. I think a lot of folks are seeing through those lies now because there's been enough discussion and enough movement and enough, you know, activism on college campuses and all over the place to call out the fallacy of equating criticism of Israel with automatic anti-Semitism. And when I was on those calls to revise and approve the curriculum and all that, a lot of folks, a lot of the public comment were coming from Jewish folks who were affirming the importance of critiquing Zionism and critiquing the state of Israel for a lot of its decisions. And you know, just like we see with a lot of these protests out there, there's a lot of Jewish folks out there saying, not in my name, you're not going to equate criticism of a state with automatically being criticism of or hatred and bigotry towards Jewish folks. So, you know, looking back, it seems like a lot of folks who were criticizing that original draft would have done well to sit back and listen to the experts and allow us to create curriculum that, not us, like me, I'm not an expert in ethnic studies, but allow the experts to create curriculum that would help us, classroom teachers, prepare students for this moment that we are in right now. So, yeah, man, unfortunately, that hope for courage that you spoke about, hope to see some leaders have the courage to put their jobs on the line to do what's right. Yeah, I'm not too hopeful about that currently. I am hopeful about the young folks, though. I am hopeful about how they be calling out the propaganda and calling out the lies. I think a lot of the things that the pro-Israel folks have gotten away with over the decades in terms of just, you know, just mistruths and misinformation about the situation out there, I think a lot of that has been uncovered and dispelled. And I think there's a real struggle to continue to like roll that propaganda out there because young people are like, nah, we ain't falling for that. So, you know, I think this is just the latest and what's sure to be a continued story about ethnic studies in California and how it deals with the ongoing genocide in Palestine.
Yeah. Yep. I very much appreciate those comments, Manuel. And maybe just a good closing for this section of the Do Now would be to give some shout outs and props and love to all the students out there who have been leading the way on this across the country, in particular on college campuses, and really, I should say, you know, around the world at this point. But especially on college campuses, there has been some, you know, activism on high school campuses as well. And they are the trumpet bearers of truth at this point in our society. The folks who've been willing to say this is wrong, who've been willing to, you know, say that the emperor has no clothes, and who've been willing in many cases to put their bodies on the line, even if they didn't actually know that's what they were signing up for, in the first place against, you know, violent hordes of pro-genocide, you know, mobs. And of course, the, you know, organized thug operation that is the riot police. And so, you know, props to them. And I hope that we see at least a tiny fraction of mirroring of that kind of courage and moral clarity and fortitude from institutional leadership at some point, if for no other reason than to simply capitulate to the demands of your actual constituents.
Yeah. Right on. Right on. All right, Jeff. Because you insist on having this pop quiz, we got another pop quiz question before we get to, you know, actually relax a little bit, Jeff. So what's the next pop quiz question we have for today?
All right, Manuel. Next question is, what is failing more than America's crumbling K-12 public school system? And before I even hand that over to you, Manuel, the obvious answer is nothing, because you know, America's schools are crumbling and failing, so I just want to stipulate that. But what else, Manuel, could be failing more than our crumbling K-12 public school system?
Ooh, that's a good question, Jeff. That's a good question. I can think of several sports teams that I could name here, several of my favorite sports teams that continually disappoint. But yeah, more than schools, I don't think anything's failing more than our schools, Jeff, because not only are they crumbling and failing to educate our students, they're also actually indoctrinating them, Jeff. I don't know if you knew that, but they're actually indoctrinating and grooming kids, Jeff. I don't know if you knew that either. Yes. They're grooming kids. And what we need is prayer in schools. We definitely need more armed teachers, but not the groomer woke type teachers, but some of the patriotic type teachers, which there are no patriotic teachers, Jeff, because teachers are all indoctrinators and groomers, and the whole system is a mess, Jeff. So yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. I was at several grooming meetings this week, as a matter of fact, so I understand what you...
How'd you squeeze that in with all your Marxism trainings that you had to go to?
I know. Well, I was at the district office for a Marxist training, of course, and then I was at several schools for the grooming professional development, as you know, because obviously you had one this week yourself, being, you know, a leader of the group.
Oh, yeah. I led several workshops in that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Well, I mean, or are you in the woke mob meeting? I'm sorry. I may have forgotten.
Yeah, no, I'd have to look back at my calendar because they all kind of blend in together a little bit.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. All right. Back to some semblance of seriousness here, folks. The correct answer to this question is actually college. Colleges and universities. Oh. And yeah, that might be surprising to folks because we are used to thinking of our higher education system, Manuel, quite frankly, as the greatest higher education system in the world. Maybe there's a good argument for that. There certainly are lots of people who come from all over the world to study at universities in America. Maybe there's a part of that that is just good old regular American arrogance. But, you know, we're going to dig into it here, Manuel. We got some juicy information for you. So let's dig in. This story comes to us by Sierra Lyons in LA School Report. A new report from the National Center for Education Statistics found that about 40% of high school graduates who enrolled in college or a certificate program in 2013 hadn't received a degree or credential 8 years later. The study followed 23,000 students starting with their freshman year of high school in 2009. Though 74% of them enrolled in college after graduating, almost half didn't receive any post-secondary credential by June of 2021. Elise Christopher, director of the NCES Longitudinal Studies, says that the 2008 Great Recession could have influenced how this cohort thought about life, thought about life after graduation and entering the workforce. She also points out that the No Child Left Behind Act could have had an effect as well. Among the students who enrolled in post-secondary education, more than half were female. 39% of them earned a bachelor's degree among females, whereas 38% of males earned bachelor's degrees. The study also examined students by race. Despite pursuing higher education, 46% of Hispanic students and 56% of Black students earned no post-secondary credential. The NCES also looked at the income and education levels of the students' parents. About 80% of those whose families earned more than $115,000 completed their degree or credential. in comparison to 49% of students whose families earned under $35,000. So Manuel, this I think is fascinating data, because if America's high schools had a graduation rate of 60%, we would all be fired or threatened to turn into charter schools and on the front page of the paper saying how we're crumbling and failing. Yet America's higher education system, which of course is many systems together, has a 60% graduation rate, according to this data, of course. So what's going on here, Manuel? What are we thinking?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking a lot of things. I mean, my go-to initial thought, of course, is as a high school teacher, all the work that we do at the high school level to support the message that students ought to go to college like that. That's like the best option for them. And we don't say it that way, of course, but it is communicated, generally speaking. When you look across high schools across the U.S., it's very much college, 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 and then careers kind of like just like in like college and career. And that career part, you know, I think no matter how teachers like myself try to support students understanding that, like, there's multiple options, that there's multiple paths, everybody has their own path, going straight to college isn't necessarily for everybody. Don't feel less of yourself or whatever, or down on yourself if you don't go straight to a college. No matter how we word that, still just overall the message is definitely like, we are celebrating those who go straight to college, especially the big name colleges. So, you know, seeing numbers like this is just another like, is it right that we're doing that? I mean, obviously the answer is no, it's not right. I don't think it's right for us to be pushing it as strong as we're pushing it for a host of reasons. One reason being, look at just how many folks don't end up finishing. And there are many reasons why folks don't end up finishing. But in general, just the assumption that that's the best choice, the best option, needs to be continually interrogated. Now, one thing about this article that was interesting to me, and I'm not blaming the author or the publication, it was just interesting to me, is that it kind of implies that this number is somehow worse or like as bad as it's always been or something like that. But then, you know, they include in there that the last set of students that was looked at in this fashion by the NCES, the 2002 cohort, that completion rate was actually lower, the 52%, which means 48% of that cohort did not complete college versus 40% now. So to me, that's an improvement, although I didn't run all the statistical analysis, but it seems to imply that we're worse off now than before, when in reality, it seems to be like actually an improvement. But in any case, the timing of it makes perfect sense to me. We're talking about the generation of folks who were taught through the lens of No Child Left Behind, taught through a lens of test, 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 and then entered college or in the wake of the Great Recession and saw folks around them finish college, perhaps, and incur all this debt and then struggle to find a job afterwards because of the recession and struggle to get back on their feet. I remember that era quite crystal clear in so many stories coming out in all the education publications about, you know, this bartender who has a 4-year degree from this liberal arts college but can't find a job, so they're bartending, and stories like that to highlight how hard it was during the recession to find work. So to me, it makes sense if college students during the recession were looking around realizing, I'm incurring this debt and I don't see a whole lot of evidence that folks of my age group are actually able to get into a career after college that's going to support them. So why am I bothering? Like, why continue? So to me, that makes a lot of sense. Also, the experience of learning under No Child Left Behind and perhaps not really having much of a educational preparation for college type work, because so much of your history class and English class and what have you was rooted around doing better on these standardized assessments and not so much rooted around critical thinking and a lot of other things that would support you in college, but also just a love of education and a love of learning. So to me, that all makes sense. And this number, I don't know if it's a good or a bad number. To me, it seems about right. So that's my thinking about it.
Interesting. I'm fascinated by that language. It seems about right.
Expect. Like, I guess I should say okay. That. It seems about gotcha, what I would gotcha. Expect.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, to me, Manuel, what really stood out about this piece and my sort of emotional reaction throughout reading it was like, the whole world, not the whole world, the whole country loves to just heap blame upon our public school system, okay? For many of our social ills. When we have, you know, ridiculous videos online of people who don't know where any countries or states are, or people can't name a continent, or, you know, we see adults who struggle to read or whatever it might be. What do people say? Oh man, these schools are failing. Schools are so bad. The schools used to be better when I was a kid. Okay, here's spoiler alert. First of all, the schools, generally speaking, were not better. When you were a kid, they were worse in terms of outcomes, one. Second of all, the idea that, you know, the public school system, this is, albeit some defensiveness from me, Manuel, but the idea that the public school system is the originator of social injustice and inequity in our society, to me, is crazy. And that we have, which is not to say we don't have our work to do, because absolutely we do. But that is to say, the public school system does not create, you know, housing shortages, does not create homelessness, does not create mass incarceration, does not create, you know, like food deserts or other kinds of things, right? Now, we are subject to those things and in some ways like replicate the, you know, the kinds of inequitable phenomenon that exists in society, but you could close all the public schools tomorrow and we're not going to become some kind of like economic and racial utopia or something, right? Like, so there is a piece of me that is just like, people, yes, we need to hold our public schools accountable, but there is so much smoke here for lots of elements of our society if we actually are serious about tackling problems related to poverty, racism, etc. So that point aside, Manuel, the comparison of outcomes between the K-12 system and the higher ed system isn't even close, okay? If you consider that like the sort of pinnacle outcome for our K-12 system is graduation and then being prepared enough to go on to college, right, or career, the K-12 system is outperforming the higher ed system. That's a numerical fact, okay? And if you consider that the higher ed system receives all of the best prepared people, okay? Like, they only take, with the exception of community colleges, they only take the most prepared students, right? Like, they don't serve students with profound, you know, disabilities who are nonverbal or, you know, things of that nature, right? They don't take the kids who, like, barely come to school because life is really hard and they're, you know, in and out of the system or whatever it might be. They don't serve those folks, generally speaking, right? So it's like the higher ed system that is deeply, deeply, you know, inequitable gets worse outcomes when you think about it like this, even though they stack the deck in their favor by only taking the best prepared students. Now, I know there's a lot of complexity underneath this, that general statement I just made, but this to me is part of the story, Manuel. We need to be thinking about, like, what is the purpose of higher education? What, as a society, do we want and need and expect from institutions of higher education? And how do we properly resource these institutions to make sure that this kind of thing is achievable? How do we set up life conditions for folks? Because obviously the major difference between K-12 and college is that the people who go to college are adults and the people who go to K-12 education are, you know, children, and we have some custodial authority over them. So clearly there's some differences there, right? But we still need to be thinking about how do we support the students who we know are coming to college without a foundation of economic stability, you know, with having had to deal with the oppressive conditions in this country for the last 18, 19, 20 years of life, and those conditions aren't going away and making it harder for them to persist, right? The most shocking stat for me, or maybe not shocking, but troubling stat for me that we read, Manuel, that was looking at the percentages of Black and Hispanic students who finished after 8 years, okay? 46% of Hispanic students and 56% of Black students earned no post-secondary credential. The majority of Black students who started college in 2013 did not finish 8 years later. And by the way, if you go into the actual study, it also gives data about how if you take long gaps, like gaps of more than 4 months, I believe they termed it as, off in your education, your likelihood of finishing goes down dramatically. So if you haven't finished after 8 years, there's a near 0% chance that you're going to finish. Okay? Now, this is crazy, right? Like this kind of data is a problem and is something that we need to have a very serious conversation about in terms of what our institutions of higher education are doing and how we are resourcing them to support the needs of our students of color.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, numbers-wise, the number that stood out to me, just the stark difference when it came to income, like those whose families made over $115,000, like 80% of them completed a degree, and those whose families made under, what was it, $35,000, it was like 49%. It's just such a stark difference there. Like, there, you know, all of the things that complicate one's access to education and one's ability to focus on education in the midst of, at that time, and I guess in many ways now, an economy that's very, very difficult to navigate, especially those who are coming from lower income households. Like, you know, how am I going to stay in college, stay fully enrolled when we're barely making it at home? I got to pick up another job, and I certainly don't have the capacity to pay this tuition or to buy these books or whatever. So I could see why so many folks at that time, especially, but even now, will reconsider whether or not their decision to start college is a decision that they should stick with, or if they should go ahead and take that exit and find another way to make it. So there's that. But also, Jeff, there's the possibility that all those tents on campus, Jeff, all those protests, all those peaceful tents, it's making it impossible to get to class, Jeff. People have the right to their education, and these peaceful protesters who are protesting against genocide, my kid can't get to class now because he has to walk around this encampment, and that's just a bit too much, Jeff, and also anti-Semitism also, Jeff. So colleges, man, they're ruining our kids.
Yeah, that, you know, Passover Seder happening on the green on campus with, you know, Jews for Palestinian freedom or whatever, must have been just a major obstruction to your learning on campus, I'm sure.
Yep. Trying to learn here. Yeah. Excuse me. Well, Jeff, that about does it for this week's Do Now. Ongoing controversy around ethnic studies in California and college. Is it right for you? Apparently it's not working out for a lot of folks. And why does the college system seem to get away with such low completion numbers? All right, folks, we hope you enjoyed the stories. As always, let us know your thoughts. And if you haven't already, you know, thumbs up, 5 stars, whatever your streaming app allows you to do. But now it's about time for the seminar. We have a super, super dope guest in the building, Dr. Heather Harding. All right, that's coming up next. Stay tuned.
Hey folks, thanks so much for tuning in to All the Above. We really appreciate you. And as you know, All the Above is a small operation. It's just me and just Manuel, that's it. We have no sponsorships, which means we are totally dependent on our amazing audience to help support the show. So here's what you can do. Go to our website, which is aotashow.com/support. That's aotashow.com/support. There you can find links to everything you can do to support the show. You find all the links to every platform that we're on where you can like, subscribe, follow, make sure you share our show with your whole network. Also, you can donate there. We are on Venmo, we're on Cash App, and most importantly, you can find the link to our anchor page where you can become a monthly patron. Even a small donation once a month will make a huge difference in helping us continue to produce the show. Lastly, you can find there the link to get your flyest, best, latest, All the Above show merch. Okay? All you gotta do is go to aotashow.com/support. Thanks. Enjoy the rest of the show. All right, folks, welcome to today's seminar. Thanks so much for joining us. And we are absolutely thrilled to have with us today yet another super dope guest in the building, Dr. Heather Harding, coming to us from Washington, D.C., who's here to help us unpack some of these fascinating issues around how we protect our public schools in the face of these boogeyman attacks against all things DEI. Dr. Harding, welcome to All the Above.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, folks, before we jump in, let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Dr. Heather Harding is the executive director of the Campaign for Our Shared Future, a time-bound, nonpartisan campaign to defend and promote K-12 public education from political attacks. Throughout her career, Dr. Harding is focused on the intersection between access to high-quality education and racial equity. Previously, Dr. Harding served in senior positions with the Gates Foundation and Teach for America, where she is also an alumna, having begun her career with TFA as a middle school English teacher in rural North Carolina. Dr. Harding earned her master's and doctoral degrees from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, which is where Manuel and I first met her many years ago now. Welcome again, Dr. Harding, and I'm going to kick it over to Manuel for our first question.
Yeah, Dr. Heather Harding in the building for the second full episode in a row. Hugsy dopeness in the building. thank you again for being here, and especially to discuss this topic, a topic that we've discussed a lot on All of the Above over recent years, because it just seems to be no end in sight to this right-wing backlash on all things related to equity, DEI, just all things. And these attacks have been incessant and ongoing. Now, we'd love to start by having you just share with us a little bit about the work of your organization, Campaign for Our Shared Future, and its role in opposition to these attacks, because so far, the resistance to these attacks seems to have not been nearly as effective as we've needed. So talk to us about Campaign for Our Shared Future.
Sure. You did really well in the intro. And it is really exciting to be back in conversation with you guys after so many years.
Yeah.
We're all older, wiser, and yet the problems are a lot the same for our K-12 schools. But the Campaign for Our Shared Future, it's a time-bound campaign focused on defending and promoting public education, public schools in the K-12 sector. I had been working in philanthropy, supporting really professional development and curriculum for educators. And we started to hear back from providers that they didn't feel comfortable working on anti-racism in the wake of the George Floyd racial awakening. And we were like, what is going on? And essentially, providers who were working in Florida and Texas were coming to us and saying, we're being told that we can't use certain words in our work. I found that to be incredibly alarming. But also, I was like, okay, maybe it's like a communications problem. So I called a couple of communications strategists and said, can you help these folks like navigate the waters? And what I got back was, this is not a communications issue. This is a political problem. And you really need a fully blown political campaign to address this issue. That communications strategist is a woman named Ruth Ann Beck. She connected with a woman named Eliza Bayard, who had run GLSEN for a number of years, and they founded this campaign, and they called me up and they said, either you could raise $10 million for us, or you could come and work with us and lead this campaign. And so I said, ultimately decided to do that. And we have raised over $12 million over the last 3 years to fight this effort. We are in wind down. So I do want your guests to know. And the reason I want people to know is we always thought we designed the campaign to be not exist forever, because there are enough advocates and enough resources to fight the extremist threat. They just need to be knitted together. And they need, I think, in the K-12 space to understand what are the tactics and tools that actually win. And so the campaign has done four things. First, we do strategic communications, and we help people take the jargon out of K-12 work and turn it into plain language everyday folks can understand. And why that's important is because the extremist attack has really lived on misinformation and co-opting words. So, 3 years ago, nobody had even heard of this thing called critical race theory. And yet, political strategists like Christopher Rufo and Steve Bannon have been able to completely demonize the words and take something that is a graduate school concept and make it mean working on racial equity in K-12 education. And so we do strategic comms, we do messaging and training, and we also are really like committed to following what the majority opinion is. So we poll quarterly voters and parents on what they want from their public schools so we can represent that and then build coalition around that. So we do that. The second thing that we do and have done is do policy analysis. First, we were just tracking the bills. So it's hard to remember, but back in 21 and 22, the bills were just like rolling through states. You know, in some states, there would be upwards of 200 pieces of legislation that were proposed on anything from anti-CRT to don't say gay to this thing they called divisive concepts. You cannot teach them. And now they get bundled under an umbrella of parental rights. But we were tracking that so that people really understood that this was kind of a deluge of unnecessary legislation with big consequences. We learned really quickly that local school boards could signal to their state legislature that they were not down with this. And so we also started working on developing policy. Policy proposals that could be advanced by local and state legislatures protecting schools from this kind of thing. So we did that work. The third bucket of work was focused on and is focused on organizing. So as I said, we're a time-bound campaign. We don't want to exist forever. But what we know about the threat is that it comes in as many doors as possible. I used to call it like the Medusa. Medusa had her, she had 11 snakes in her hair. And we've gotten through about 8 of them, if you think of all the ways that the threat came. But, you know, in a state like Illinois, it was actually some legislation that was being reauthorized around sex education that the threat came in the door. Around including just basic information about LGBTQ folks and families. And so you need to knit together coalitions of folks who would be sex education advocates, along with educators, along with parents who want access to information and families. And so we had to do on-the-ground organizing in states where there was a lot of activity. We had part-time organizers in somewhere between 8 and 11 states over the years, and we choose those in a number of ways. Like the first year was around the midterm, because 2022 was a midterm election. And then the last 2 years, we focused on where there's critical mass of school board elections. School board elections happen whenever they want. Like there's no, in fact, when we started this work, there was no national database of when school board elections happen. We have one now. It can be found on under the pipelinefund.org page. You can look up when your local elections are, unless you're in a state like Pennsylvania or Florida, which have statewide race days. But yeah, we just had to have people aware. And actually the rise and now fall of Moms for Liberty drew us into a bunch more organizing work fighting against misinformation campaigns. And then the final piece of the campaign, it's a lot of work, was we were C3 and C4. We just closed our C4, but we did endorsement work around the school board races where some of the school boards were being taken over. And so we developed a program to decide whether candidates were interested in that common ground agenda, both a pro-equity, but also a pro-inclusion approach to education. And when we found candidates that met that threshold, we endorsed them, sometimes supporting local actors to provide dollars or ads or whatever they might need to push back on a threat. That's what the campaign for our shared future has been about. Like I said, we're in wind down. We're going to close, shutter our doors unless somebody comes and decides they want to revive it in November of this year. And, you know, It's funny that you say we have been not as effective fighting the threat. I would say coming out of the November elections this last year in 2023, what we have are great proof points for how you can stop these threats. And now we just need to share out the multiple tools to do that. And a lot of it is really like saying, the banning books is bad. Americans don't like it. And being really clear about what the motives are for people who want to come in and take rights away from certain families in the name of sort of parents' rights and protecting young people. So I think we can really win. I feel optimistic, but the threat is real. Like, it can't go unanswered.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for the very comprehensive explanation of your organization and also for the work that you all have been doing for the last several years. I personally was just in a strategy meeting over the last week with a bunch of local organizations here in Southern California who are organizing around these same sorts of things. We live in this sort of blue bubble, so to speak, that is California, but the snakes on Medusa's head are right over there. And
California is a hot spot. You think of it as a blue state. It's a hot spot for this kind of stuff.
absolutely. And they are finding their way in every little crack and nook and cranny that that there is. So very much appreciate the work and the explanation there. And our next question I wanted to ask you because to me it has felt as an educator, it has felt very much like we are just being hit from all angles constantly. And I have taken to calling this like essentially a campaign of psychological warfare against us, against educators, against marginalized communities, generally speaking, against students, particularly low income, Black and brown students, and have been seeing it that way. I wonder, from your perspective, how if you could say a bit more about sort of how you see the nature of the attack in that way, and in what ways, you mentioned just a minute ago needing to sort of be very clear about language and that sort of thing, which I love. I wonder if you can go a little deeper down that road and help us kind of unpack, how should we be reframing the discussion here and speaking against these kinds of attacks.
Thank you. That's a great question. I love to talk about this. I've been in K-12 my entire career, so 25 plus years. First a teacher and then a supporter of teacher working in nonprofits. And I guess I always thought of teaching as a political act, but essentially, teaching and public schools are foundational to democracy, right? Not only is it where we sort of learn the fundamentals of how to be citizens? It's also like one of the still few places in our country where we encounter people who are different than us and have to learn alongside them and learn how to get along with them. And if you do follow the extreme rhetoric of the political strategist, their intention really is to undermine democracy by weakening the public trust in public institutions. And so public education is one of them. If we as citizens think that our schools can't and don't serve us, we will not be interested in who governs around them. And that's a big idea. And, when I first sort of thought it through, I was like, oh, I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist. And yet here we are. Our American democracy
Yeah.
is super fragile right now. And so, like, there's a way in which I remember a few years ago, some of the pro-voucher, who sometimes use the language of universal choice, but I'm going to use voucher in this conversation because the pro-voucher people started talking and naming public schools government schools. And I thought that was so odd, but now I understand it. If you are trying to shake the public confidence in government managed entities, then it would make sense that you would call it a government school. It's a public school. What are you talking about? That's crazy, right? So that's the first tenet that we need to like really understand that that's where this is coming from. And then I think like Most Americans actually are not down with like ending public education. They're just not. Like, most Americans need their public schools to supervise and keep their children safe and teach them the, basic skills and knowledge that we all expect American citizens to have or young people to have. So we don't even have to go down the citizen sort of route. Public schools serve all kids that show up at the door. Like, that's what we've been doing. That's what we've come to expect. And so, one way that is important to start is we talk about families teach values and schools teach knowledge and skills. And we can all pretty much agree on that, that the school's job is to help families and young people like realize the dreams that their families have for them. That's not a relationship of conflict. That's a relationship of collaboration. And so while there might be conflict to manage, when we encounter folks who are screaming and yelling and trying to undermine, we need to stop and think about what is that going to solve. So from our polling, what we found is that talking about the dreams that families have for their young people and how school and educators can get their kids there really is a great neutralizing way to answer the real concerns of parents, right? Because some of them are made up. The other thing, though, that we talk about, there are like four message points that we found really helpful. One is families, everything, as I've just said. Two is that it's about collaboration. Educators and families have always worked together. Schools, listen, you all, I know, as lifelong educators yourself, teachers are desperate to have parents come in and help or yell or whatever. Like, this is their lifelong dream. So that's an important one. Like, you work together. The third one, and this one can sometimes be dicey depending on the audience, but the United States is generally a good country. Like, we're trying to pull ourselves out of the gutter here, but the truth is that, like, it's a good country. It's not perfect. And this gets to some of the censorship issues in the book banning and the attempt to tell a different history to the country, one that doesn't include things like the Rosa Parks story. But like, it's a good country, and telling the stories where the country has been over to overcome adversity is central. And then the fourth thing is like that schools really aren't a place for politics. And that much of this legislation attack is coming from politicians who are either trying to drive fear or trying to make a name for themselves. And that's not what the school is for. So those are the ways that we start conversations to actually see where there's alignment between folks who are complaining or attacking schools versus folks who actually like care about making sure our schools can do the job that we need them to do. But the one other thing I want to say is, I do think that we've been under attack for a long time, and so the weariness, like what you were saying, Jeff, around like it seems like there's something new every day, that is reflective of the fact that these campaigns and attacks are well funded and relentless and willing to morph to whatever issue of the day causes the most panic. So I said before that like anti-CRT was a whole thing. Then, we've seen an onslaught of attacks on LGBTQ and trans children and families, and now it's DEI as the boogeyman. There's always a boogeyman. And trying to stay ahead of that takes a lot of resources as well.
Yeah, actually, that's what we wanted to ask you about, because there, the boogeyman has definitely shifted over time. And, I re clearly recall the early anti-CRT days and just thinking like, how did CRT come up in conversation, and why are they trying to make it out to be something that it's not? And then, of course, we saw shifts from that to the, Don't Say Gay bill, and shifts from there on to, teachers are a bunch of groomers and they're indoctrinating our kids. And then, of course, the parental rights, parental rights. And it seems like a constant shifting. And of course, right now, DEI seems to be in the spotlight. So we want to know if you have any thoughts about how or what the next shift might be, or in just in general, how could we be more proactive and less reactive to these shifts as they have been happening?
You know, we feel pretty sure that through the rest of the year and through the election cycle, so the presidential election cycle, that there will continue to be attacks on what the extreme right calls gender ideology. Mm. So this debate around biological gender and sex and like all that stuff, which, you know, the trans fight is an extreme minority fight, right? Like the folks who are in our society who identify as trans, it's a small group of people. And so the lack of exposure means that popular opinion is lagging. And so we see that the other side sees that as a winner, that's something to exploit. I remember when it first popped up in that we were hearing from educators that if they had pronouns in their signatures, that they were going to be less likely to get contracts or be invited in again. There wasn't, you know, there was sort of like under the cover radar advice, don't put pronouns in your signature and your email. It's a trigger. The words equity all of a sudden was a dirty word. And so DEI stuff is now sort of the new dirty word. I don't know what's coming around the corner. I wish I could. You did. But I think like the way to protect yourself, and I say this with like the greatest emphasis, is lean into what is good for kids. And lean into, for educators, lean into your professional judgment. I like to remind folks, I'm a parent. I got a couple of kids at public school, their entire experience. I was an educator, but I am not a reading teacher. Could not have taught my children to read. Teaching kids to read is really hard. And one of the greatest gifts that their kindergarten and first and second grade teachers gave me is my children were really proficient readers. And when those teachers gave me advice about selecting text, about helping, I remember my son had trouble with grammar. Like I listened. And so even when the trust in educators is eroding, they are still the experts on how to help our kids teach, learn. So I just want to encourage teachers and educators to lean into their professional judgment. So if somebody says, gee, you know, I think we should have the Bible as literature in grades 3 through 5. And what would be wrong with that? And you're the reading teacher and you think, gosh, that vocabulary is going to, those intellectual concepts are going to be really tough for third grade. Not asking you to negate the fact that in Bible school and in religious institutions, Bible, of course, is a piece of literature and is being taught. But if you're in K-12 public schools, you might think about what is important about teaching reading. What is a challenging text versus an affirming text? Like, teachers know stuff. Like, we are professionals. And I think our opinion on those things really matter. And for families who've had experiences with teachers who have cradled and taken care of their young people, that's the biggest, like, I don't want to use war analogy. That's the biggest tool that we have, is our real knowledge and our commitment to young people's learning. So that's what we say to people, and we believe it. We try to stay values aligned. We also try to make space for, like, it's not that, you know, teaching the Bible or having students read the Bible is a bad thing. So I'm not trying to step on people's religious toes, but I feel like it's really important to say why a thing is not in the service of learning and not in the interest of schooling. It's the same thing around like social emotional learning and this indoctrination or groomers thing that you raised. First of all, it's shameful to call teachers and librarians groomers. And given the work that, you know, we do on behalf of young people, and given the already existing careful infrastructure for exposing kids to content, right? Like, oh my God, it just boils my blood. But it is an important thing to acknowledge what families want for their kids. And most teachers and educators are happy to do that work. And so if a family comes in and you know, kind of tries to destroy that, we need to be concerned about that behavior as well.
Yeah, wow. Dr. Harding, I feel like we could talk to you all day about all these issues. We do have one final question for you, which gets at something you mentioned a little bit ago around the sort of extent to which the discourse around education right now is dominated primarily by politics, or at least some version of politics that's being dressed up as a conversation about actual educational practice. But you know, it really is being driven by politicians and in this sort of political sphere rather than just serious and genuine discussions about what good practice is in the schoolhouse. So with that in mind, wondering if you can share some insights or maybe advice for educators who are seeing that and grappling with that in their context and thinking about how to, you know, sort of advocate for good practice, particularly in service of marginalized students of all sorts, knowing full well that the kinds of, you know, threats and that sort of thing, you know, they're like, what do I put in my signature in terms of pronouns, that these are very real decisions that folks are having to make. I wonder if you could share some thoughts or insights around how folks should, you know, advocate for good practice in service of the communities who we know need and deserve good practice from their schools.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to give practical advice around what is going to cause you to be flagged. So I don't share the pronoun story because I want you to take the pronouns out of your signature. I just share it because it's a flag. And I think it's fair for any of us as individuals to understand what might be putting a target on our back. But the good news is that we don't have to go alone. Like, 70%+ of Americans, regardless of political party and racial affiliation, want schools to address these topics and support an inclusive education. The challenge has been the extremists, a minority view, are super loud and ugly. And so one of the things that our campaign is so proud of is what we tried to do is to help people identify others in their local community who will show up with them. So you don't have to go alone. I mean, it's always scary to be the first person that stands up and says, we're not going to do that here. You need to know that there are going to be people who have your back. So every educator should know the majority of your community probably has your back. And so silence should not be your option when you see these attacks resulting in things that will hurt kids. So I like to say that. I think it is, though, important to understand where misinformation campaigns might be literally just like undermining the good opinion or and the good brand of your school or your education. So like we found in lots of communities that people were getting mailers and, you know, just hearing stuff that was just not true. And so you do have to find the messengers who are trusted to debunk that kind of stuff. But the more silent, the worse it gets until people come back together. I love the story from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is largely a Republican county. where they're like number one for book banning last year, and their whole or four out of the six school board seats were taken over by Moms for Liberty types. One of the remaining board members ended up like putting together, working with the coalition. She retained her seat, and then she recruited other community members to run and unseat the folks who had taken over as extremists. And she got sworn in on a stack of banned books this fall. And she's
Wow.
chair of the board now. And that was in a 2-year cycle. So if you think, if you're in a place where like you're being inundated, know it can be taken back over. Know that if there's a threat, it can be put down. But you do have to organize, you have to gather people, you have to make sure they know we're not going to show up alone. We're not going to leave you out hanging. So I think that's important. And run for your local school board.
Wow. Love that we get to end on a note of resistance and triumph and resistance there. So very much appreciate that. Folks, we have come to the end of our discussion here today with Dr. Heather Harding of Campaign for Our Shared Future. But thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Harding. If folks want to learn more about your work and your organization's work, where can they go?
We have a website, campaignsharedfuture.org. We have lots of resources. So we have a playbook for organizing in your community. We also have message guides. So this issue of language, given how important it is, and lots of tools on the website, and contact information if you need for us to actually talk you through things that are going on locally that we might be able to advise or help you with. And guys, thank you for doing the podcast. I'm so excited, both for the work, and for the conversation and the folks who are listening in.
Absolutely. Well, we appreciate you. Dr. Heather Harding, thanks so much for joining us today. Folks, that's it for our seminar, but next up is our class dismissed. Stick around.
All right, folks, we have reached that point in the episode where we like to give shout outs to folks doing wonderful things in the world of education. This here is class dismissed. Jeff, who are we shouting out today?
Well, Manuel, today we're going to shout out a whole bunch of people. And we're going to shout out a movement of people here today, Manuel. And I'm sure everyone, at least in the United States and in many parts of the world as well, has seen the massive amounts of media coverage, much of it trash from mainstream corporate media, but media coverage nonetheless of the student protests happening across college campuses in the United States. Demanding from their universities various sorts of actions to help bring about an end to the genocide taking place in Palestine, genocide and other things, ethnic cleansing, etc. Using the levers of power that they have to force institutional action in the form of divestment, in the form of recognition of what's happening, and in the form of things like ending collaborative agreements with state actors and non-state actors in Israel until the day that this genocide comes to an end. And we wanted to both collectively acknowledge the courageous actions of the students, many of which are risking their academic and in some cases their professional future, risking money, risking criminal records, as we've seen very violent and over the top police responses to these protests and encampments. And Manuel, we want to point out that there have been some bright spots of success. And we don't have a comprehensive list of all of them, but there was a great story this week that came out of Democracy Now! An interview it was with four students representing four different college campuses across the United States. Evergreen State College up in Washington State, Middlebury College in Vermont, Brown University in Rhode Island, and Rutgers University in New Jersey, who were interviewed about what was happening on their campuses, which is protest encampments that had taken up on their campuses and then The strategic choice was made to take them down after winning concessions and feeling like they had gotten good signs of progress in negotiations with the administration. So one of these I wanted to share with you came from Evergreen State College, and a student who was interviewed named Alex Marshall said, "Our demands were formulated through a process of consensus within the encampment, and we focused on divesting from companies that are profiting off of Israel's occupation of Palestine. Changing Evergreen's grant acceptance policy to no longer accept funding from Zionist organizations that support stifling students' free speech, as well as police services, community review board structure to be created, and the creation of an alternative model of crisis response. Evergreen also agreed to prohibit study abroad programs to Israel, Gaza, or the West Bank until the day comes when Palestinian students would be allowed entry. And they also agreed to release a statement calling for a ceasefire and acknowledging the International Court of Justice's genocide investigation." This is comparable to what the students achieved at other universities with either commitments to, that of course take some process with the powers that be, to divestment and to ending collaborative agreements with institutions in Israel. So Manuel, we are seeing at least the first steps of movement thanks to the courageous and brave actions of these students. So we want to recognize and give a shout out to all the, you know, this beautiful coalition of multi-racial, multi-ethnic, multi-faith student organizing happening across the country, acting as the moral conscience of the United States right now. Thank you. We salute you. We see you. And let's have some more good institutional action like this from universities across the country.
Yeah, man, most definitely, most definitely. I can't help but hear all that as a UCLA Bruin and think about just how badly my university fumbled all of this. You know, we were at a time, you know, not to bring it to local institutional rivalries or anything, but we were at a time where USC was really stumbling and bumbling with their approach to this issue and just making clown show of itself. And UCLA said, "All right, hold up, hold my beer. We got this."
Hold my beer. And, exactly.
It was just very, very sad, you know, very peaceful encampment. And UCLA decided to sit back and allow this very peaceful encampment to be attacked in the middle of the night by a bunch of Proud Boys and racists, and just brutal attack on the peaceful encampment. And the university responded to that by saying, "Oh, this encampment is not safe. Let's bring in the LA sheriffs and the LAPD. And the CHP, and let's run essentially a militarized operation in the middle of the night to break down this whole thing." So just shame on the leadership at UCLA. Folks, by the time you hear this episode, our chancellor, Gene Block, he might be up out of there because folks are calling for his resignation in a very loud way because of just how poorly the leadership of the university responded to legitimate and peaceful protests calling for an end to a genocide. So yeah, there's that. All right, not to end on a downer, shame on UCLA. Kudos to all those folks, all those universities, all those students that you just mentioned, Jeff, and of course all the other ones around the world that are making their voices heard. I saw a post from Al Jazeera shouting out students in Spain who have been marching and protesting at universities across Spain. And spoiler alert, the police have not shut them down. The police have not caused any violence there. So we don't always need a militarized police force to
Sure don't.
To show that we're free. Like, come on now. All right, folks. That about does it for this episode of All of the Above. We appreciate everybody for hanging around to the end of the episode. Of course, you can catch all of our recent episodes and past episodes at our website, AOTAshow.com. And remember to hit that thumbs up, 5-star review, all that good stuff. AOTAshow.com/support. If you want to help contribute financially to this 2-person operation to help keep us going. So love y'all, appreciate y'all, and we'll see y'all next time.